anyone. Then why am I supposed to be giving you money I work my damn tail off for, huh? Runner said, his voice bitter. That's what I never understand, this idea of handouts. Alimony and child support and the government with its hands in my pockets. I can barely support myself. I don't know why people think I need to take 3 extra jobs to give money to my wife, who has her own farm, her own house on the farm, and 4 kids to help her out with it. I mean, I sure as hell didn't grow up thinking my daddy owed me a living. My daddy ought to give me money for Nikes and college and dress shirts and... Food? Ben said, looking down at his broken boots with sloppy Joe stains on them. What's that? What's that you say to me? Runner was in his face now, those blue irises rolling around in the yellow orbs like fish on the surface of a bad lake. Nothing, Ben mumbled. You want money for your hair dye, that it? Want money for the beauty parlor? He wants money for his girl, Trey started, but Deandra was giving him quick axes across her throat. No, no, no. Well, I'm definitely not in charge of buying things for his girlfriend, Runner said. You his girlfriend now, Deandra? Small world. But definitely ain't my business.
The men at the pool table had stopped playing altogether, sneering at the scene, and then the white-haired guy limped over, put a firm hand on Trey's shoulder.
Problem, Trey? Runner here, he's good for it. Give him another 24 hours, okay? On me. Understand?
The man had a wishboned stance, like gravity was pulling him toward the ground by both legs, but his hands were muscled, sinewy, and they pressed into Trey's shoulder. Runner smiled, wiggled his eyebrows up and down at Ben, signaling they should both be pleased.
Don't worry, buddy, it's okay, he told Ben. It's okay now.
Trey tightened his shoulder under the man's hand, seemed about to shrug it off, then stared into the middle distance.
Sure. 24, okay, Whitey. On you. Appreciate it, Injun, the man said.
He winked, made a cheerful, creaky noise with his mouth like he was calling a horse, and rejoined his friends, a rustle of laughter going up from the group just before the pool ball clacked.
Piece of shit pussy, Trey said to Runner. Tomorrow night here, or so help me, Runner, I will hurt you.
Runner's victory rictus, that Halloween smile, faded, and he nodded twice, and as he was turning to the bar, snapped,
Fine, but then stay out of my business.
Man, I cannot wait to stay out of your business.
As they started to leave, Ben waited for Runner to say something to him. Sorry, see ya, something. But Runner was already trying to talk the bartender into giving him one on the house, or maybe on Whitey. Whitey would stand him around, and he'd already forgotten about Ben. So had Trey and Deandra. They were busting through the doors, and Ben stood with his hands in the front pockets of his pants, caught sight of himself in the mirror, looking so different, and he watched himself in the mirror as he turned around to Runner.
Hey, Dad, he said,
and Runner looked up, annoyed he was still there. It was that feeling of pestiness that made Ben want to make Runner respect him. He'd felt the tiniest jingle of camaraderie before, that word, buddy. He wanted it back. He had pictured, just a quick flash, him and his dad at the bar having a few beers together. That's all he really wanted from the guy, just a beer together every so often.
I just wanted to tell you something. It might make you feel, I don't know, good.
And Ben started grinning, couldn't help himself. Runner just sat there, sleepy eyes, not giving any expression.
Deandra's pregnant. Deandra and I are having a baby.
And then his smile split wide for the first time. For the first time really feeling good, saying it out loud like that.
Going to be a dad. A dad, with some little one depending on him, thinking he was it.
Runner tilted his head to the side, lifted his beer sloppily, and said,
Just be sure it's yours. I doubt it's yours.
Then he turned his back on Ben. Outside, Trey kicked the side of his truck, screamed between closed lips,
I tell you what, that old crew better die off soon, because I'm sick to fucking death of them protecting their own. You're telling me it's honor? It's not. It's old white guys trying to hold on to the last bit of business before they start shitting themselves and need name tags attached to them so they know who they are. Fucking whitey.
He pointed a finger at Ben. The snow everywhere, floating down Ben's shirt and melting on his neck.
And your old man is a piece of crap if he thinks I'm believing his line of bullshit. I hope you're not too attached to him, because I'd like to flush him like a piece of shit.
Let's just go, Trey, Deandra said, opening the door, ushering Ben into the back seat. My dad is going to come home next week, and I'll be dead anyway. Ben felt like hitting himself. The one thing he wasn't supposed to tell, and he'd wasted it on Runner. Ben was so angry as soon as he got in the back seat, he began punching it blindly, spittle shooting from his mouth. Fucker, fucker, fucker! Kicking at the cushion, banging his knuckles on the roof of the car, hitting his head on the window glass over and over until his forehead was bleeding again. Deandra yelling,
Baby! Baby, what?
I swear to God, I swear to fucking God, Deandra, fuck! Annihilation. He could never tell Deandra he'd told.
Someone should fucking die,
Ben spat. He put his head in his hands, could feel Trey and Deandra consulting each other, silently. Trey finally saying,
Your dad's a fucking douchebag, dude.
He threw the car into reverse and squealed out into the street, knocking Ben against the window. Deandra snaked a hand back and stroked Ben's hair until he sat upright, barely. A pile. Deandra's face was green under the lamplight, and suddenly Ben could see what she'd look like in 20 years. Flabby and pimply like she described her mom, her skin hard and wrinkled, but with that electric glow from the tanning booths.
There's stuff in the glove compartment, Trey said,
and Deandra popped it open and began rifling through it. She pulled out an oversized pipe crammed with leaves, the pot spilling everywhere. Trey saying,
Easy now.
And then she lit it and toked in, passed it to Trey. Ben reached up a hand. He was almost sick now, so shaky from lack of food, dizzy from the streetlights fluttering. But he wasn't going to be left out. Trey kept it from him.
Don't know if you want this, buddy. This is me and Deandra's thing. Hard-ass weed. I'm serious, Deandra. It may be tonight. I need the power in me. I haven't felt it in too long. It may have to happen.
Deandra kept looking up ahead, the snow dizzying.
Ben might need it too, Trey pushed.
Fine, let's do it then. Take a left up here, Deandra said.
And when Ben asked what was going on, they both just smiled.
Libby Day, now. The sky was an unnatural purple when I left the Lidgerwood bar, bouncing on back roads toward the Superfund site. I wondered what it said about me, that my own father was living at a toxic waste dump, and until now I'd neither known nor cared. Grasshopper bait. Bran and molasses and arsenic to help end the grasshopper plague back in the 30s, and when folks didn't need it anymore, they just buried it. Bags and bags, open grave style. Then people got sick. I wished I had someone with me. Lyle fidgeting in the seat next to me in one of his shrunken jackets. I should have phoned him. In my nervous rush to get down here, I hadn't told anyone where I was, hadn't used a credit card since filling up in Kansas City. If anything went wrong, no one would miss me for days. Those guys at the bar would have the only clue to where I'd be, and they didn't seem like good citizens. This is ridiculous. I said out loud, so I knew it. I shivered when I thought of the reason I was looking for Runner. A goodly amount of people believed he killed the Days. But I still couldn't make it work in my head, even without the alibi. I had trouble picturing Runner using the axe, in truth. I could see him grabbing a shotgun in a temper, raise, cock, pow. But the axe didn't fit. Too much work. Plus, he was found at home, asleep and still wasted, the next morning. Runner would have gotten drunk after killing his family, yes, but he wouldn't have had the discipline to stay put. He'd have gone on the lam, accidentally announcing his guilt to everyone. The dump site was marked off by cheap metal fencing, jagged holes cut into it. Waist-high weeds grew everywhere, like prairie grass, and tiny bonfires flashed in the distance. I drove along the perimeter of the fence, the weeds and loose gravel rattling against the undercarriage of my car more and more insistently until I came to a stop. I closed the car door with a quiet tamp, my eyes on those distant flames. It'd be about a 10-minute tromp to reach the camp. I slipped easily through a wire-snipped hole in the fence to my right, started walking, foxtail swatting my legs. The sky was draining quickly now, the horizon just a cuticle of pink. I realized I was humming Uncle John's Band to myself, for no good reason. Scraggly trees stood in the distance, but for the first few hundred yards, it was all rolling, waist-high weeds. Again, I was reminded of my childhood, the safe feeling of all that grass grazing your ears and wrists and the insides of your calves, like the plants were trying to soothe you. I took a few loose strides and jammed the point of my boot into a woman's ribs, actually feeling the bones part as the leather tip slid between them. She had been curled on the ground in a puddle of piss, her arms wrapped around a label-less bottle of liquor. She sat halfway up, groggy, the side of her face and hair caked with mud. She hissed at me with a withered face and beautiful teeth. "Get off me! Get off me!" "What the hell?" I yelled back, taking a scurry of steps away from her, my arms up in the air like I was worried about touching her. I walked briskly on, trying to pretend it hadn't happened, hoping the woman would pass out again, but she kept yelling after me, between gulps off the bottle. "Get off me! Get off me! Get off me!" The screams turning into song, turning into weeping. The woman's cries aroused the interest of three men, whose faces appeared from behind the crooked copse of trees I was walking toward. Two of them glared at me, belligerent, and the youngest one, a skeletal man, maybe in his 40s, shot out, running toward me full bore, bearing a stick he'd lit on fire. I took two steps back and planted myself.
"Who is it? Who is it?" he yelled.
The thin flame of his torch weakened in a gust of wind and blew out as he neared me. The man trotted the last few steps, then stood in front of me, staring limply at the ember and smoke, his machismo turned to sulking with the loss of the fire.
"What do you want? You shouldn't be here. You have to have permission to be here. It's not okay."
The man was goggle-eyed, smudged everywhere, but his hair was glowing yellow, like a cap, as if it was the one thing he took care of.
"It's not okay,"
he said again, more toward the trees than me. I wished then that I'd brought my Colt, and wondered when I'd stop being so goddamn stupid.
"I'm trying to find a guy by the name of Runner Day."
I didn't know if my dad had bothered with an alias, but I assumed even if he had, he'd have forgotten it by his third or eighth beer. I was right.
"Runner? What do you want with Runner? He steal something from you? What'd he take? He took my watch and he won't give it back."
The man slouched into himself, like a child, picked at a loose button at the bottom of his shirt. Just off the path, about 40 feet away, I saw an irritation of movement. It was a couple, rutting, all legs and hair and faces bunched up in anger or distaste. Their jeans were both bundled around their ankles, the man's pink ass going like a jackhammer. The yellow-haired man looked at them, giggled, and said something under his breath, like, "Fun." "I'm not upset with him, with Runner," I added, pulling his attention back from the couple. "I'm just his family."
"Runner!"
the man abruptly screamed over his shoulder. Then he looked back at me.
"Runner lives in that farthest house, out on the edge of camp. You got any food?"
I started walking without a reply, the couple climaxing loudly behind me. The bonfires got brighter and closer together as I hit the main drag, a scorched bit of ground, dotted with tents that sagged like storm-ruined umbrellas. A big fire pit blazed in the center of camp, A woman with deep jowls and a distant stare was tending the flames, ignoring the cans of beans and soup that were turning black from the heat, their innards sizzling over. A younger couple with scabby arms watched her from half inside their tent. The woman wore a child's winter hat partway on her head, her pale face peeking out, fish belly ugly. Just past them, two old men with dandelions woven into their matted hair sat greedily eating food out of a can with their fingers, the thick stew steaming in the air. "Come on, Beverly," the scabby man snapped at the fire tender. "I think it's damn done." As I walked into the campsite, they all got quiet. They'd heard the screaming of Runner's name. One old man pointed a dirty finger farther west. "He's over there." And I left the heat of the fires and walked into the cool brambles. The hills rolled more now, like fat ocean waves, just 4 or 5 feet high, row after row. About 9 hills away, I could see it, a steady glimmer, like a sunrise. Up and down, floating along, I reached the top of the final ridge and discovered the light source. Runner's home, it turned out, was an industrial-sized mixing vat, which looked like an above-ground pool. Light poured out of it, and for a second I worried it was radioactive. Did grasshopper arsenic glow? As I started toward the tank, I could hear the amplified echoes of Runner's movements, like a beetle walking across a steel drum. He was whispering to himself in a schoolteachery, chastising voice. "Well, I guess you should have thought of that before, Mr. Smarty." And the tank was broadcasting the noise out into the sky, which was now the violet of a morning dress. "Yeah, I guess you really did it this time, Runner Man," he was saying. The tank was about 10 feet tall, with a ladder up one side, and I began hauling myself up it, calling out my dad's name. "Runner, it's Libby! Your daughter!" I bellowed, the rust of the ladder making my hands itch. Gargling throat sounds came from within. I climbed a few more rungs and peered inside the tank. Runner was bent at the waist, retching onto the tank floor, and suddenly he expelled a purple, globular mess, like an athlete might spit chaw. Then he lay down on a soiled beach towel, adjusting a baseball cap on his head sideways, nodding as if some job, somewhere, had been well done. A half dozen flashlights glowed around him like candles, illuminating his craggy, tan face and a pile of junk, knobless toaster ovens, a tin pot, a pile of watches and gold chains, and a mini fridge that wasn't plugged into anything. He lay on his back with the loose pose of a sunbather, one leg crossed over the other, a beer to his lips, a saggy 12-pack carton at his side. I hollered his name again, and he focused his eyes, pushed his nose at me when he saw me, like a mean hound dog. It was one of my gestures. "What do you want?" Runner snapped up at me, his fingers tightening around his beer can. "I told everyone, no trade tonight." "Runner, it's Libby. Libby, your daughter." He raised himself on his elbows then, twisted his hat toward the back. Then he swiped a hand across the lace of dried saliva on his chin. He got part of it off. "Libby!" He broke into a grin then. Little Libby. Well, come on down, sweetheart. Come say hi to your old man." He struggled to an upright position, standing in the center of the tank, his voice sounding deep and melodic, bouncing off the walls, the flashlights giving him a crazy campfire radiance. I hesitated on the ladder, which curled over the top of the tank and then ended. "Come on, Libby. This is your old man's new home." He held his arms up to me. The drop into the tank wasn't dangerous, but it wasn't a gimme. "Come on! Jesus Christ on a crutch, how far you come to see me, and now you're gonna be a scaredy scared?" Runner barked. At that, I swung my legs over the edge and sat on the rim like a nervous swimmer. After another, "Aw, Jesus!" from Runner, I started awkwardly lowering myself. Runner had always been quick to brand his children as crybabies, cowards. I only really knew the guy for one summer, but it had been a hell of a summer. His mockery always worked on me. I'd end up swinging from the tree branch, jumping off the hayloft, throwing myself into the creek even though I couldn't swim. Never feeling triumphant afterward, just pissed. Now I was lowering myself into a rusted tank, and as my arms started to shake, my legs flail, Runner came up and grabbed me by the waist, dislodged me from the wall, and started twirling me around in tight, manic circles. My short legs spun out around me like I was 7 again, and I began struggling to stick them on the ground, which only made Runner grip me harder, his arms sliding up beneath my breasts, me floating like a rag doll. "Stop it, Runner! Set me down! Stop it!" We knocked over 2 flashlights, which went cartwheeling, their rays bouncing everywhere. Like those flashlights that hunted me on that night.
"Say, Uncle,"
Runner giggled. "Put me down." He spun harder. My breasts were smashed up to my neck, my armpits aching from the strain of Runner's grip.
"Say, Uncle! Uncle!"
I screamed, my eyes squeezed in fury. Runner released me. Like being thrown from a swing, I was suddenly weightless in the air, soaring forward. I landed on my feet and took 3 big steps till I hit the side of the tank. A big metallic thunder boomed up. I rubbed my shoulder.
"Man, my kids always were the biggest babies."
Runner panted, both his hands on his knees. He leaned back and cracked his neck, loudly.
"Pass me one of them beers, sweetheart."
That's how Runner had always been. Crazy, then not, and expecting you to pretend whatever indignity he'd just inflicted on you never happened. I stood with my arms crossed, made no move for the beer.
"God damn it, Debbie, or Libby, what your women's lib now? Help your old man out."
"Do you know why I'm here, Runner?" I asked.
"Nah."
He walked over and grabbed himself a beer, shot me an eyebrowy look that made his entire forehead disappear into folds. I had assumed he'd be more shocked to see me, but Runner had long ago pickled the part of his brain capable of surprise. His days were so baggy and pointless, anything could happen in them, so why not a visit from a daughter after half a decade?
"How long's it been since I seen you, little girl? You get that flamingo ashtray I sent you?"
The flamingo ashtray I got more than 2 decades ago, when I was a non-smoking 10-year-old. "Do you remember the letter you wrote me, Runner?" I asked. "About Ben? About how you know he wasn't the one who... did it?"
"Ben? Why would I write to that jag-off? He's a bad un. You know, that wasn't me that raised him. That was all his mom. He was born weird and he stayed weird. He'd have been an animal, he'd have been the run of the litter, and we'd have put him down."
"Do you remember the letter you wrote me just a few days ago? You said you were dying, and you wanted to tell the truth about what happened that night."
"I sometimes wonder if he was even mine. Like if he was even my kid. I always felt kind of like a sucker raising him. Like people were probably laughing about it when I wasn't around. 'Cause ain't nothing about him that reminds me of me. He was 100% your mother's boy, mama's boy."
"In the letter. Remember the letter, Runner, just a few days ago? You said you knew it wasn't Ben that did it. Did you know, even, that Peggy is taking back your alibi? Your old girlfriend, Peggy?" Runner took a deep pull off the beer, winced. He looped one thumb over the pocket of his jeans and gave an angry laugh.
"Yeah, I wrote you a letter. Forgot about that. Yeah, I'm dying. Got scoli... what's it with the liver when it goes bad?
Cirrhosis?"
"Right, got that. Plus something wrong with my lungs. They say I'll be dead within the year. Knew I should have married someone with health insurance. Peggy had some. She was always going to get her teeth cleaned, get prescriptions."
He said it like she was dining on caviar. Prescriptions.
"You should always get health insurance, Libby. Very important. You ain't shit without it.
He studied the back of his hand, then blinked.
So I wrote you a letter. Few things need to be put to rest. A lot of shit went down that day of the murders, Libby. Thought about it a lot. It's tormented me. That was a bad damn day. Like a cursed day. A cursed day, he added, pointing at his chest. But man, there was so much finger-pointing going on then. They'd put anyone in jail. I couldn't come forward like I wish I could have. Just wouldn't have been smart.
He said it like it was a simple business decision. Then he burped quietly. I pictured grabbing the tin pot and smashing it across his face. Well, you can talk now. What happened, Runner? Tell me what happened. Ben's been in prison now for decades, so if you know something, say it now.
What, and then I go to jail?
He gave an indignant grunt and sat down on his beach towel, blowing his nose on one corner.
It's not like your brother was some babe in the woods. Your brother was into witchcraft, devil shit. You hang around with the devil, sooner or later you're gonna have to fuck. Should've known it when I saw him with Trey Tipano, that fucking fucker.
Trey Tipano, the name that kept coming up but went nowhere. What did Trey Tipano do? Runner broke into a grin, one cracked tooth leering over his bottom lip.
Boy, people do not know shit about what went on that night. It's hilarious.
It's not hilarious. My mom is dead. My brother is in prison. Your kids are dead, Runner. He cocked his head at that, stared up at a moon as curvy as a wrench.
You're not dead, he said.
Michelle and Debbie are dead. Patty is dead.
But why aren't you? Don't you ever wonder?
He spat out a jelly of blood.
Seems weird.
What's Trey Tipano got to do with it? I repeated.
Do I get some reward money or something if I talk?
I'm sure, yeah.
I'm not innocent, not entirely, but neither's your brother, neither's Trey.
What did you do, Runner?
Who ended up with all the money? Wasn't me.
What money? We had no money.
Your mom had money. Your queen bitch mom had money, believe me.
He was standing now, glaring at me, his oversized pupils eclipsing his irises, making his blue eyes look like solar flares. He tilted his head again in a twitchy, beast-like way and started walking toward me. He held his palms outward as if to show he wasn't going to hurt me, which just made me feel like he would.
Where'd all that money go, Libby, from Patty's life insurance? That's another mystery for you to think on, because I sure as shit don't have it.
No one got money, Runner. It all went to defend Ben. Runner was standing right on top of me now, trying to scare me the way he did when I was little. He was a small man, but still had a good 6 inches on me, and he breathed on me hard, his breath all warm, tinny beer. What happened, Runner?
Your mom, always keeping money to herself, never ever helping me. And I put years in on that farm, never seen a dime. Well, the chickens came home to roost. And your goddamn mom brought it on herself. She'd have given me that money.
You were asking her for money that day?
All my life, I owed people money, he said. All my life, never able to get ahead, always owing. You got any money, Libby? Hell yeah, you do. You wrote that book, didn't you? So you're not really innocent either. Give me some money, Livy. Give your old man a little cash. I'll buy me a liver on the black market. Then I'll testify to whatever you want, whatever baby wants.
He poked me with two fingers in the middle of my chest and I began slowly trying to back up. If you were any part of that night, that will be found out, Runner.
Well, nothing was found out back then. Why should anything be found out now? You think the cops, the lawyers, everyone involved in that case, everyone who got famous from that case?
He pointed at me now, his lower lip jutting out.
You think they're just gonna, what? Oops, our mistake. Here you go, Benny boy. Go ahead and enjoy your life.
Nah.
Whatever happened, he's in there the rest of his life.
Not if you tell the truth.
You're just like your mother, you know, so cunt. Never go with the flow. Always do things the hard way. If she'd just helped me once, in all those years, she was such a bitch. I'm not saying she deserved to die.
He laughed, bit a hangnail.
But man, was she a hard woman. And she raised a goddamn child molester. Sick fuck. Never, ever was that kid a man. Oh, and you tell Peggy she can suck my dick, too.
I turned to go at that and realized I couldn't get back up without Runner's help. I faced him again.
Little baby Ben, you really think he did those killings by himself? Ben!
So who was there, Runner? What are you trying to say?
I'm saying Trey, he needed money. He was a bookie who needed to be paid.
By you?
I'm not gonna cast aspersions right now, but he was a bookie. And that night he was with Ben. How do you think he got into that shit-ass house?
If that's what you think happened, if you think Trey Tipano killed our family, you need to testify to that, I interrupted. If that's the truth.
Wow, you know nothing.
He grabbed me by the arm.
You expect everything. Want everything for free. One big handout. Me risking my neck for... I told you to bring money. I told you.
I slipped his grasp, grabbed the mini-fridge, and began dragging it over below the ladder, the thing rattling loud enough to drown out Runner. I climbed up on it, and my fingers were still several inches short of the top of the tank.
Give me $50 and I'll get you up, Runner said, assessing me lazily.
I stretched to grab the edge, up on my tiptoes, straining, and then I could feel the fridge tilt beneath me, and I fell to the ground, fast, hitting my jaw, biting the side of my tongue, my eyes watering from the pain. Runner laughed.
Jesus, what a mess, he said, looking down at me. You scared me, little girl?
I skittered behind the fridge, keeping my eyes on him as I looked for things to pile on it, climb out.
I don't kill girls, he said, out of nowhere. I wouldn't kill little girls.
And then his eyes brightened up.
Hey, did they ever find Deirdre?
I knew the name, knew what he was trying to say. Deandra?
Yeah, Deandra.
What do you know about Deandra?
I always wondered if they killed her that night. You never saw her after that night.
Ben's girlfriend, I prompted.
Yeah, right, I guess. Last time I saw her, it was with Ben and Trey, and I sort of hope she just run away. I like the idea of being a granddaddy sometimes.
What are you talking about?
Ben had got her pregnant. Or that's what he said. Made a big deal out of it, like it's hard to do. So I saw her that night, and then she never showed up again. I worried she might be dead. And that's what they do, devil worshippers? Kill pregnant ladies and their babies. She sure did disappear.
And you didn't say anything to the police?
Well, how's that my business?
Patty Day, January 2, 1985, 9:12 p.m. The house had gone silent for a few beats after Runner sped away, finding someone else to bully for money. Peggy Banyan. She was his girlfriend now, Patty'd heard. Why doesn't he go harass her? Probably already had. One beat, two beats, three beats. Then the girls had turned into a mess of questions and worries and small hands everywhere on her, as if they were trying to get warm by a really weak campfire. Runner was scary this time. He'd always had a bit of menace to him. He'd always been temperful when he didn't get his own way. But this was the closest he'd come to attacking her. For the most part. When they'd been married, there'd been tussles, little slaps upside the head, designed more to infuriate, to remind you of your helplessness than to really hurt. Why is there no food in the fridge? Smack. Why is this place such a shithole? Smack. Where does all the money go, Patty? Smack, smack, smack. You listening to me, girl? What the hell you do with all the money? The man was obsessed with cash. Even in a rare fatherly moment, grudgingly playing Monopoly with his kids, he'd spend most of his time sneaking money out from the bank, clutching the bright orange and purple bills in his lap. You calling me a cheat? Smack. You saying your old man's a cheat, Ben? Smack, smack, smack. You think you're smarter than me? Smack. Now, nearly an hour after Runner had left, the girls were still huddled on her, near her, behind her, all over the sofa, asking her what was wrong. What was wrong with Ben? Why was Dad so mad? Why'd she make Dad mad? Libby sat the farthest from her, tucked in a bundle, sucking a finger. Her worried brain stuck on the visit to the Cates' house, the cop. She looked feverish, and when Patty reached out to touch her cheek, she flinched. It's okay, Libby. No, it's not, she said, unblinking eyes fixed on Patty. I want Ben back. He'll come back, Patty said.
How do you know?
Libby whimpered. Debbie hopped on that. Do you know where he is? Why can't we find him? Is he in trouble because of his hair? I know why he's in trouble, Michelle said in her most wheedling voice. Because of sex. Patty turned on her, furious at that simpering, gossipy rhythm. A hair and curlers whisper in the supermarket tone. People were using that tone to discuss her family all over Kinnicky right now. She grabbed Michelle by the arm, harder than she meant to. What do you mean, Michelle? What do you think you know?
Nothing, Mom. Nothing, Michelle blurted. I was just saying, I don't know.
She started to blubber, as Michelle did when she got in trouble and knew she'd done wrong. Ben is your brother. You don't talk hateful about your brother. Not inside this family and definitely not out of it. That means church, school, whatever.
But Mom, started Michelle, still crying. I don't like Ben.
Don't say that.
He's bad. He does bad things. Everyone at school knows.
Knows what, Michelle? She felt her forehead start burning. Wished Diane were there.
I don't understand what you're saying. Has Ben... Are you saying Ben has done anything bad to you?
She had promised herself she would never ask this question, that it was a betrayal of Ben to even think it. When Ben had been younger, 7 or 8, he'd taken to sliding into her bed at night, and she'd wake up with him running fingers through her hair, cupping a breast. Innocent but disturbing moments in which she woke up feeling sensual, excited, and then darted from the bed, pulling robes and nightgowns around her like a horrified maiden. No, no, no. You don't touch Mom like that. But she never suspected, until now, that Ben might have done anything to his sisters. So she let the question hang, while Michelle got more and more agitated, pushing her big glasses up and down her pointy nose, crying.
Michelle, I'm sorry I yelled at you. Ben is in trouble. Now, has he done anything to you I need to know about?
Her nerves were jagged. She had moments of pure panic, followed by moods of complete remoteness. She could feel the fear rising now, that propulsion, like taking off in an airplane.
Done what to me? Has he touched you in a strange way? A not brotherly way?
A free-floating gap now, like the engines shutting off.
The only time he touches me is when he's pushing me or pulling my hair or shoving me,
Michelle droned her usual litany.
Relief. Oh, relief.
So what do people say about him at school?
He's a freak. It's embarrassing. No one likes him. I mean, just look in his room, Mom. He's got all sorts of weird stuff.
She was about to lecture Michelle on not going into Ben's room without his permission and wanted to slap herself. She thought about what Detective Collins had said, the organs of animals in Tupperware containers. She imagined them. Some dried in tight wooden balls, others fresh and assaulting when you open the lid, let the smell hit you. Patty stood up.
What's in his room?
She started walking down the hall, Ben's goddang phone cord tripping her up as always. She marched past his padlocked door, down the hall, turned the corner left, past the girl's room and into her own. Socks and shoes and jeans lay everywhere, each day's flotsam abandoned in piles. She opened her bedside table and found an envelope. In case of emergency, scrawled on the front in Diane's elongated cursive that looked just like their mother's. Inside was $520 cash. She had no idea when Diane had sneaked that in her room, and she was glad she hadn't known, because Runner would have sensed her holding out. She lifted the money to her nose and smelled it. Then she tucked the envelope back inside and pulled out a bolt cutter she'd bought weeks ago, just to have on hand, just if she ever needed to get into Ben's lair. She'd been ashamed. She started back down the hallway, the girl's room looking like a flop house, beds against each wall except the doorway. She could picture the police wrinkling their noses. They all sleep in here. And then the aroma of urine hit her, and she realized one of them must have wet the bed last night. Or the night before. She debated switching out the sheets right then, but made herself walk straight back to Ben's, stood eye level with an old Fender guitar sticker he'd partly scraped off. She had a quick moment of nausea when she almost decided she couldn't look. What if she found incriminating photos? Sickening Polaroids. Snap. The lock fell to the carpet. She yelled at the girls, peeking out from the living room like startled deer, to go watch TV. She had to say it three times. Go watch TV! Go watch TV! Go watch TV! Before Michelle finally went away. Ben's bed was unmade, rumpled under a pile of jackets and jeans and sweaters, but the rest of the room wasn't a pit. His desk was piled with notebooks and cassette tapes and an outdated globe that had been Diane's. Patty spun it, her finger leaving a mark in the dust near Rhodesia, then began flipping through the notebooks. They were covered in band logos, AC/DC with the lightning slash, Venom, Iron Maiden. On the notebook paper, Ben had drawn pentagrams and poems about murder and Satan. The child is mine, but really not, 'cause Satan has a darker plot. Kill the baby and its mother, then look for more and kill another. She felt a ripple of illness, as if a vein running from her throat to her pelvis had gone sour. She riffled through more notebooks, and as she shook the last one, it flipped naturally to the middle. For pages and pages, Ben had drawn ballpoint pictures of vaginas with hands going into them, uteruses with creatures inside, grinning demonically. pregnant ladies sliced in two, their babies half falling out. Patty sat down on Ben's chair, feeling giddy. But she kept flipping until she came to a page with several girls' names written in pancake stack rows. Heather, Amanda, Brianne, Danielle, Nicole. And then, over and over in progressively embellished Gothic cursive, Chrissy, 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 Chrissy Day, Chrissy Day, Chrissy D Day, Chrissy D Day, Chrissy D Day, Chrissy Day inside a heart. Patty rested her head on the cool desktop. Chrissy Day. Like he was going to marry little Chrissy Cates. Ben and Chrissy Day. Is that what he thought? Did that make what he did to her seem okay? Did he picture himself bringing that little girl home for dinner? Letting Mom meet his girlfriend? And Heather. That was the name of the Hinkle girl who was at the Cates's. Were the rest of these names even more girls he'd hurt? Patty's head was heavy. She willed herself not to move. She would just keep her head right here on the desk until someone told her what to do. She was good at this. She sometimes sat for hours without leaving a chair, her head bobbing like a nursing home inmate, thinking about her childhood, when her parents had their list of chores for her and told her when to go to bed and when to get up and what to do during the day. And no one ever asked her to decide things. But as she was staring at the rumpled sheets on Ben's bed with the airplane pattern and remembering him asking for new sheets, plain sheets, about a year ago, she noticed a wadded plastic bag jutting out from underneath the bed frame. She got down on her hands and knees, pulled out an old plastic shopping bag. It had a weight to it, swung out like a pendulum. She peered in and saw only clothing, and then she realized she was looking at girly patterns, flowers and hearts, mushrooms and rainbows. She dumped them out in a pile on the floor, afraid, even as she was doing it, that those Polaroids she feared would tumble out with them. But it was just clothes, underwear, undershirts, bloomers. They were all different sizes, from Chrissy's age to toddler. They were used, as in, they had been worn by little girls, just like the detective had said. Patty put them back in the bag. Her son. Her son. He would go to prison. The farm would be gone. Ben would be in jail. And the girls... She realized, as she too often did, that she didn't know how to function properly. Ben needed a good lawyer, and she didn't know how to do that. She walked into the living room, thinking about a trial and how she couldn't bear it. She scattered the girls back to their bedroom in a fierce voice, them staring back at her with open mouths, hurt and scared, and she thought about how she made things even worse for Ben. A single mother who was incompetent, overwhelmed. How much worse it made him look. And she put some kindling and newspapers in the fireplace and just a few logs on top. And she set fire to the clothes. A pair of underpants with daisies on them was just catching at the waistband when the phone rang. It was Len the lender. She started to make her excuses, explained that there was too much going on to talk about the foreclosure. There was a problem with her son. "That's why I phoned," he interrupted. "I heard about Ben. I hadn't been going to phone before, but I think I can help. I don't know if you'll want it, but I have an option."
"An option for Ben?"
"A way to help Ben, with legal costs. What you're facing, you're going to need a bundle."
"I thought we were out of options," Patty said.
"Not entirely."
Len wouldn't come out to the farm.
he wouldn't meet her in town. He got all clandestine on her, insisting she drive out to the rural Route 5 picnic station and park. They haggled and bickered, Len finally breathing a big huff into the phone that made her lips twist. "If you want some help, come out there now. Don't bring no one else. Don't tell no one. I'm doing this because I think I can trust you, Patty, and I like you. I really want to help you." A pause came on. So deep, Patty looked at the phone receiver and whispered, "Len?" into the phone, already thinking he was gone, that she was about to hang up. "Patty, I really don't know how to help you, but this. I think, well, you'll see. I'm praying for you." She turned back to the fireplace, sifted through the flames, saw only half the clothes were burned. No logs left, so she hurried into the garage, grabbed her dad's old axe with its heavy head and razor-sharp blade, back when they made tools right, and chopped up a bundle of wood, carried it all back in. She was feeding it to the fire when she felt Michelle's swaying presence at her side. "Mom!" "What, Michelle?" She looked up, and Michelle was in her nightgown, pointing at the fire. "You were about to throw the axe in with the wood." Michelle smiled. "Scatterbrain?" There was the axe laid across Patty's arms like kindling. Michelle took it from her, holding the blade away from her as she'd been taught, and set it beside the door. She watched Michelle walk hesitantly back to her room, as if she were picking through grass, and Patty followed in her daughter's footsteps. The girls were all piled on the floor, murmuring to their dolls. There was that joke people told, that they loved their children most when they were sleeping, ha-ha, and Patty felt a small stab. She really did like them best when they were sleeping, not asking any questions, not needing food or amusement. And she liked them second best when they were like this, tired, calm, disinterested in their mother. She put Michelle in charge and left them there, too worn out to do anything but take direction from Len the Lender. "Don't hope for too much," she told herself. "Don't hope." It was a half-hour drive through bright snow, the flakes turning to stars in her headlights. It was a good snow, as Patty's mom, the winter lover, would say. And Patty thought how the girls would be playing in it all day tomorrow, and then thought, would they? What happens tomorrow? Where will Ben be? Where is Ben? She pulled up to the abandoned picnic area, the shelter a big slab of concrete and metal built in the 70s with communal tables and a roof that was angled like some failed attempt at origami. Two swing sets sat beneath 4 inches of snow, their old black rubber seats not swaying at all, as Patty thought they should. There was a breeze. Why were they so still? Len's car wasn't there. In fact, no car was there. And she started to fidget with the zipper of her coat, running a fingernail on each metal tooth so it made a clicking noise. What might happen? She would go up to the picnic bench and find Len had left her an envelope with a stack of cash, a gentlemanly gesture she would repay. Or maybe Len had organized a bunch of folks who felt pity on her, and they were about to arrive and wonderful life her with cash handouts. Patty realizing everyone did love her after all. A rap came on her window. Bright pink knuckles and a man's thick torso. It wasn't Len. She rolled her window partway down and peered out, ready for him to tell her to move along, lady. It was that kind of rap. "Come on," he said instead. He didn't lean down. She still couldn't see his face. "Come on. We'll talk up on the benches." She shut off the car and pulled herself out. The man already walking up ahead, bundled under a thick ranch coat and a Stetson. She was wearing a wool hat that had never fit right, Her ears always popped out. So she was already rubbing at the tips when she reached the man. He seemed nice, was what she thought. She needed him to be nice. He had dark eyes and a handlebar mustache, the tips drooping off his chin. He was probably 40, looked like he might come from around here. He looked nice, she thought again. They settled down on the picnic benches, pretending they weren't covered in snow. Maybe he was a lawyer, she thought. A lawyer Len had talked into representing Ben. But then why would they be meeting out?
Here you got yourself some trouble,
he said in a rumbly voice that matched his eyes. Patty just nodded.
About to foreclose on your farm, and your boy's about to be arrested.
The police just want to talk to him about an incident that...
Your son is about to be arrested, and I know what for. In this next year, you will need money to fend off your creditors, so you can keep your children at home, in their own goddamn home. And you will need money for a lawyer for your son, because you do not want your son to go to prison labeled a child molester.
Of course not, but Ben...
No, I mean, you do not want your son to go to prison labeled a child molester. There is nothing worse you can be in prison than a child molester. I seen it. What they do to those men? A nightmare. So you need a very good lawyer, which costs a lot of money. You need one right now. Not weeks from now, not days from now. Right now. These things get out of control fast.
Patty nodded, waiting. The man's speech reminded her of being with a car salesman. You had to do it now, and this model, and at this price. She always lost these conversations, always took what the salesman insisted she take. The man pressed his Stetson down, breathed out like a bull.
Now I myself was once a farmer, and my daddy before me and his daddy before him. 800 acres, cattle, corn, wheat, outside Robinette, Missouri. Fair amount, like your operation.
We never had 800 acres.
But you had a family farm. You had your goddamn land. It's your goddamn land. We've been swindled, farmers. They say, plant fence post to fence post, and we goddamn well did. Buy more land, they say, 'cause they ain't making more of it. Then, whoops, sorry, we gave you some bad advice. We'll just take your farm. This place been in your family for generations. We'll just take this, no hard feelings. You're the jackass believed us, not really our fault.
Patty had heard this before, thought it before. It was a raw deal. Let's get back to my son. She leaned on one haunch and shivered, tried to seem patient.
Now, I'm no businessman. I'm no accountant. I'm no politician. But I can help, if you're interested.
Yes. Yes, I'd like that, she said. Please. And in her head, she told herself, don't hope. Don't hope for too much.
Libby Day, now. I drove back home through sickly forests. Somewhere down one of those long, stringy roads was a landfill. I never saw the dump itself, but I drove through a good 20 miles of float-away trash. To my right and left, the ground flickered with 1,000 plastic grocery bags fluttering and hovering just above the grass, looking like the ghosts of little things. Rain started splattering, then got thicker, freezing. Everything outside my car looked warped. Whenever I saw a lonely place, a dimple in the landscape, a copse of whiskery trees, I pictured Deandra buried beneath, a collection of unclaimed bones and bits of plastic, a watch, the sole of a shoe, maybe the red dangly earrings she wore in the yearbook photo. Who gives a tinker's damn about Deandra, I thought, Diane's phrases again popping into my head. Who cares if Ben killed her? Because he killed your family, and it all ends there anyway. I'd wanted so badly for Runner to give something up, make me believe he did it. But seeing him only reminded me how impossible it was that he killed them all, how dumb he was.